by G.P. and Amelia as they were going along, but it was actually written by, do you know who actually wrote the book, Last Flight? I believe her first name was Helen. I have it in the...
It wasn't Studer.
No, it wasn't Clara Studer.
Yeah.
You know Clara Studer?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Okay. Is she still alive?
No, I think she died last summer.
She'd gone to Italy the last I heard. Mm.
I don't know because I didn't know her. And
she was quite a person. Quite a person.
Well, so many of those early girls were poorly girls.
Yes, yes.
They were very famous.
I think the very first talk that I was asked to give was to Zonas and San Jose.
Exactly.
And the last one was last year down at Salinas.
Oh, for heaven's
sake. And that's when they gave me a beautiful silver medallion.
Well, I have presented the Amelia Earhart medal, you know, the one that was done by Brenda Putnam.
Uh-huh. Yes,
I have presented those all around the world.
Is that the one that I have then? It had the world in the back of it and the trips that she'd made?
No. This was the first one.
Well, tea or some tea if you have it.
Tea
is all right.
We'll go. Coffee, tea, milk.
I think I like mine
iced. I prefer coffee if you have it. Just instant suits me.
Iced tea would be fine.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm going to put anything that's left over. Okay, whatever.
Well,
someplace in my record I have all these dates, but I cannot remember.
Well, you're a 99.
Yeah.
Do you know that you 99 should credit your name to me because I refused to join in the beginning and there were 99 acceptances. So
well,
now just think, if I'd accepted, you'd have had to have a different name.
You would have been the 100th. Is that
yes,
it?
And that wouldn't have been a very nice name for her.
Well, I don't know.
Well, I was not in an area where I wasn't when she organized the 99s. I was not flying.
Mm-hmm.
I had to wait till I got out of college and earned my own money to learn how to fly.
But you see, I had retired entirely.
Ursula Hettinger Bueller, who is the fixed-wing chief of Swiss Air Rescue.
Oh, is that so? Well, during World War II, I did search and rescue.
Did you?
On the border between Canada and New York State.
Oh. Well, she has more hours in a Learjet than any other woman.
Well, I've never flown a jet.
And taught herself, because her father didn't want her to fly.
Yeah, that's mine.
She went out and learned on her own.
Well, I learned on my own, too, and I had a heck of a time learning, because women were not very popular around airports. And I spent more money in instruction and never even was allowed to solo until I said, well, this has to quit. So I bought my own airplane, and then I couldn't fly it, but didn't make any difference. I had a friend who she was a little whiz, I'll tell you, of a pilot. I learned more from her than I did from any man instructor I had. And so she was trying to get into the WASP. And this was in the very early beginning. And she wasn't quite tall enough. And her eyes were not so.
How tall did you have to be?
Well, I don't remember now. You see, I'm no good at figures and numbers. But anyway, her father didn't want her to fly. He wanted her to go to school, and she quit school because she wanted to fly. And then so he kicked her out of the house, and she was working for a fixed base operator. And then we... So when I decided that it dawned on me what the trouble was, that I could never get a chance to solo. Because every time I called, I was working, and every time I called for an hour or two, well, they said either an instructor was not available or a plane wasn't available. So I fiddled around with that for a long time before, you know, slow on the uptake. And I just couldn't realize that it was being done. But when I realized it, then I says, I'll fix that. So I bought my own airplane. And you probably never heard of the thing. It was a rear wind. Did you ever hear of it?
No.
Well, nobody else has either.
Rear wind or tailwind?
Rear wind, W-I-N. And I think they were made in St. Louis.
Rear wind speedster.
Huh?
Rear wind speedster.
No, I had the Cloudster.
Cloudster?
Uh-huh. Now, I think that was made in St. Louis.
Yeah, I've heard of the rear wind.
Have you?
Company,
yeah. Yeah, I think that was anyway.
Were you in the Wasp venture?
No, no. No, I wouldn't get in the Wasps under Cochran. I should say not.
Oh.
Uh-huh. Oh, I would have if Nancy Love had still had them. But, no.
Did any one of you three ever read, oh, gosh.
Yeah.
From High Point, North Carolina.
Jacqueline's book?
No, in fact, she was the second president in 99, didn't she? She lives. She lives in High Point, North Carolina.
Oh, I don't know.
Oh, she flew the Twin Beach. She flew the. Huh? Yeah.
Louise Thayer.
Yes, I've met her, but I don't know her personally.
Did you ever read her book?
No.
It was written in 1938 about women flying in the military.
Oh.
It was written in 1938, and
yeah.
It was extremely interesting.
I bet that was. Uh-huh. No, I haven't. I always try to get everything I can. I think I have most of the books on the media.
Guys, I was going to get you to. I thought maybe you were in the Wasp, and you'd get Jacqueline to let me interview her.
Yeah, well, good luck. You wouldn't have any trouble. She's right set for that sort of thing.
She likes it.
Yeah, she loves it.
Well, ladies,
did you ever heard her?
You're gonna
I hope you're coming back.
Oh, it's all set.
I don't know.
Take it real quick before you go. It's all set. Come on, we're going to all move over and have
no for you.
It's on tape.
Have you ever heard her make up anything, don't you?
No, I have.
Okay.
I'll tell you, she can't even read.
Let me call my own.
Correctly, that's been written for her.
Yeah, she tries, hon. She tries.
I
heard about you, too, and all of these famous people that I've been rubbing noses with the last 2 or 3 days. It's going to take a while to get me back under cloud now.
Oh, wow.
Can I help you if that's carry anything? Or I'm going to practice there.
Shut this off. Linford H. Hines, and it's now 5:15. It's July 25th, 1976, and we are at Mr. Hines's apartment house at 8111 East Broadway in Tucson, Arizona. Well, that's Panalau Memoirs. Maybe you remember Eddie Bryan, who was one of the curators at the Bishop Museum.
I think I do.
His picture's in there.
He's probably one of those that we
and,
cut up
now,
the birds in there.
Yeah, that'd be his bag. And he now runs this Pacific Scientific Information Center, and he put this book out, just kind of chronicalizing.
Sometimes he'd use a spare room. Our spare room.
And you'd use your spare room?
Yeah, and the one of us, of course. He'd have the place so sticking in there, you'd hate to pass it from dead birds. He'd be cutting up in there. And we'd say, for goodness sake, get a hose in there and wash the place out.
Now, let's get back to that business of officers and warrant officers and enlisted men. Actually, as a warrant officer,
You were more of an officer than you were an enlisted man. Is that correct?
Oh, you are considered an officer.
But I meant in the Coast Guard in 1937 now. Mm-hmm. A chief was considered more of an enlisted man.
Oh, a chief is an enlisted man.
Right.
See, a warrant officer, they usually got all the warrant officers from the chiefs. I was one of the youngest warrant officers in the Coast Guard. I don't look it now, I know. But Mellon come on the ship, Secretary of the Treasury, and had all the officers lined up on the quarter deck, and he got to me and he said, "How old are you?" I said, "I'm 25. He said, "How in the world did you get to be a warrant officer at 25? I said, "I was a chief petty officer at a permanent appointment 3 years ago." He said, "You were?" He said, "When did you go in the Navy?" I said, "I was about 16 when I went in the Navy. I went in World War I. And I was a little bit underage.
Now, you used to stand watches, and you were officer of the deck, and stood to regular watches there. How did you happen to get qualified for that?
Well, I took international correspondence courses, and I run away from home when I was very young, and I was selling papers with the fleet when I was 12 years old.
All right, let's go back a minute. Let's get you born. Where were you born, where and when?
Norfolk.
You were born in Norfolk, Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
When was that?
1901.
What's your birthday?
February.
Remember the day?
17th.
February 17th, mm-hmm. 1901.
Yeah, I'll be 76 this coming February.
Okay, now, were you raised in Norfolk?
No, I left, my father didn't find me for about 4 years. And I was in New York at the time.
In New York?
Yeah, I was selling papers to the fleet. I was following the fleet around.
I see.
And I'd go out to the battleships with about 200 or 300 papers. I sell them to the ship, to the men on the ship, and back to Sherika.
And if the fleet went to Baltimore, you'd go to Baltimore.
Yeah. Oh, they'd never go to Baltimore.
Huh?
They wouldn't ever go to Baltimore.
Well, wherever they went.
They'd go to New York, go to Lynn Haven Road, and a couple of us would get together. We'd rent a boat, a motorboat, to take us out to the Southern Drill Ground, about 20 miles off of Lynn Haven Road. And we'd have papers, and we'd carry... The officers had used the asses to bring cream out, fresh cream, for coffee and stuff like that. And then the sailors had asked us to smuggle cigarettes. You know, they wasn't allowed to have cigarettes then.
They weren't?
Oh, no. Bull Durham was all they could have.
Why was that?
And they wasn't allowed it. They could smoke them, sure, but they couldn't on a ship. You'd see every sailor with a Bull Durham tag hanging out of his...
Why was that?
You were just a young fella, that's all.
Oh, I
in the old days.
Why was that?
Well, I don't know, but they just didn't want them to smoke so much, I guess. And it was Bull Durham. They had to roll every one of them. When I first went in, it was nothing but Bull Durham.
After World War II.
I was in Europe, in World War I.
Yeah, but after World War I, then that was...
Oh, after that sometime, I don't know what it was. Nobody said anything about smoking. They had cigarettes all they wanted.
Well, did you have a good... Now, you didn't have a very good relationship with Ham Meyer.
With who?
With Captain Meyer of the
No,
Army.
I didn't...
Did you have a pretty good relationship? Was there anybody else, either enlisted or officers or civilian, that you...
No, I got along with everybody else, I think, pretty good.
You and Meyer just had a little bit of a...
Just that business of calling me down and trying to show that Warren
officers
wasn't entitled to sir or mister. And if he reads the Coast Guard regulations or the Navy regulations, he'll find that Warren officers and chief Warren officers shall be addressed as mister or sir whenever they are spoken to.
Now, Bill Swanston was... By the way, he lives near Battle Creek, in Battle Creek. He's doing fine. This is the sister in Michigan. Bill was navigation officer on the Itasca in 37. Mm-hmm. Sweet Nelson was previous mm-hmm. to that.
Yeah, he was.
And Bill Swanston took over. And Bill being navigator, took the 4 to 8 watch usually, mm-hmm. and so he could get his.
I'd be stuck with the mid watch every
yeah,
time.
Yeah, and you were standing night watches
yeah,
mostly.
I got most of them.
When he would check the gyro when the sun rose, he would use the amplitude of the sun to check the gyro in the morning.
Yeah, he'd check it.
How would you do that? Physically, how would he do that?
I would never do it.
No, but how would the navigator do it that morning? Would he go out and use the Polaris on the bridge wing?
I think that was the way he'd have to do it, was use the Polaris on the flying bridge. He had Polaris on both sides of the bridge, and I'd use the standard compass on the flying bridge. And check that at the same time.
Okay, now, I have a notation that the one of the radio men was getting a time tick for the chief quartermaster. Would he be doing that for the ship's chronometers or was there some routine procedure that
I never heard of that.
I never have either.
I never heard of that. The chief quartermaster was the one that used to take care of chronometers.
Well, he would have to go down to the radio shack then, wouldn't he, to get the time tick, because the radio men would be...
Well, he'd get it from the radio shack with using the torpedo boat watch. You know what that is?
No.
That's a big one. That's a big watch. It's a regular pocket watch, but it's about that big, and they call it the torpedo boat watch. That's the one they usually take around, and they they get a tick on that, and then they check that with the chronometers.
And then they go up to the bridge.
Then they work a C-minus W up there.
I see. And what if they were taking a shot, and the quartermaster, would he use the torpedo when he took his...
They'd use that rather than use their own watch, because they wouldn't know where the hell they were with their own watches. So they use a torpedo boat watch most of the time.
And that was usually up on the
and
bridge.
And on all ships, destroyers and everything else.
And you think that the Itasca had one in 37 like that?
I think the Itasca, I don't even remember how they did it at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Okay.
I don't remember what they did.
Now, getting back to your guns for a minute, each 5-incher then had 2 6-volt batteries underneath the gun.
Mm-hmm.
And these had to be taken somewhere to be charged. Where were
they? I'd charge them myself. I had a charger in the armory.
In the armory, you had a charger.
I had a
and
charger.
And you do it from the ship's power then?
And whenever I was on a ship like the Gresham or one of the other ships, if I didn't have a charger in the armory, I'd take it down to the electrician and let the electrician put it on charge.
But on the Itasca,
we had a charger in the armory.
You had a charger in the armory. So how often would you charge those batteries?
Whenever they needed it. Sometimes.
You check it with a hygrometer.
Yeah, I'd check it with a hydrometer, and if it didn't have enough kick to it, sometimes take a screwdriver on there, and I'd find out whether it had a little kick to it. If it didn't have much, I'd put it on charge for a little while.
Okay, now they're going to take this direction finder ashore. And they don't have any batteries for it.
I don't know how the hell that ever got mixed up. Because I know that day they were using all of my batteries. I think they had all of them.
You think they took all 4 of them?
I believe they were using them in the radio shack, too. I wouldn't know, but I know that morning everybody seemed to want a battery. That is where we left the ship. We left the ship about 4 o'clock in the morning because she was supposed to get there any time early.
It didn't really matter. Because in the one chance in a billion that you might need the gun, you could still fire it manually.
Yeah, it would fire manually, whether they had power or not.
And the 3-pounders had nothing to do with it. 6-pounders had nothing to do with it.
Nothing.
So really, it didn't, that the batteries were gone didn't hurt you.
That didn't make
much.
A bit of difference, hardly.
Now, where did it get the power to ring the buzzer?
Well, I think that was from the regular generators. Hooked up the regular generators from the fire control. That is a line running from the fire control down to the gun. And you'd press the buzzer on the fire control and it would buzz on the gun.
But wouldn't you have to have a battery backup? You could never use ship's power for fire control on a...
I don't think we did have one, a backup for that on the Itasca. I don't believe we did. If we did, I didn't know anything about it.
Well,
I would have known if they had a battery. I would have
yelled to the pointer to tell the guy to fire or...
And the pointer would use his mechanical fire in any way, because the firing pin would hit that primer just the same. It hit at the same time as
why did you? But you did have the batteries there for the electrical for the electrical fire.
Oh yeah, that was for the lights on there too. See, for the lights on the gun.
Well, what's the lights for?
The sight lights. Then you have a little tiny covered light over top of the range and deflection.
Oh, I see. All these indexes.
Little tiny
indexes have
bulbs
about
on. That big.
For night firing.
Yeah, and that's for night firing too, so you can see where to set the ranges.
Thought of that.
Well, yeah, you have to have them because they...
So that's what those batteries were for,
yeah,
then?
Mostly. But
okay, now, does that
them,
tell you what the voltage had to be for those bulbs?
They were damn small. They weren't as big as... any bigger than that.
They were like... But they were just like automobile lights.
Yeah, just little tiny bulbs. So.
In fact, they were probably were automobile.
Mm-hmm. They probably were.
And that
but
means
they had a socket, they screw them in.
And then that means they had to be 6 volt.
No, they didn't have a socket. Or it didn't
have a
screw in. It had a bayonet joint.
And they were probably automobile type because
everything
was 6 volt in those days.
Mm-hmm. I think they were all 6 volt, all the batteries we had.
Well, and can you remember any more about these batteries? Okay. For instance, how many ampere hour do you think they were?
That I couldn't say now. I wouldn't venture anything on that because I don't remember what that would be. I know they'd last quite a while because I'd go up and check them to find out if the lights were on the gun because I'd turn the lights on the gun to see if I had power and to see if it was on the range and deflection. And it would come on or... I'd say it was all right. But if it'd been there for a long time, I'd pull them off and charge them.
So you really, on a day-to-day basis, didn't really know if the batteries were fully charged or not then?
Oh, yes. You knew where they were, but they were all right. You knew they were working anyway.
But you didn't know if they were fully charged or not?
No, you couldn't tell whether they're fully charged. But if you were getting lights... the kind of light you get all the time when it's fully charged, you don't worry about. But it once starts dimming, that's when you do worry about.
Now, you had two batteries. So if one went dead, you switched the other one.
Yeah.
And each battery was about all that one man could carry.
Oh, they were heavy things.
Could one man carry
them? Yeah, one man could carry them, but they were awkward and heavy to carry.
Okay. That tells me about what size they are. They must have been about something like, 60, 70, 80 ampere hour to be that big and heavy.
I don't remember just what they were rated at now. But they were big, awkward things. Mine is a 12 volt. It's only that big right now. I just had a brand new one. I have my car 6 months old and had a battery go dead on me.
Something wrong with it.
Yeah, there's something wrong. So I went in and they put a new battery in. It's only that big. About the size of this book. 12 volt. And by the battery I had on there, I bet every one of them are that long at least.
That's about 15 inches long.
Yeah.
And probably about 10 inches, 12 inches wide.
They wasn't that wide. They would be about that wide.
About 8 inches wide.
Yeah.
8 inches wide and 16 inches long.
They were big things.
And what did you say? They stood about how high?
No, they're about the size of the height of them now. About that high.
They were
something
about,
like about 8 or 10 inches, something like that.
Well, that's not a very big battery, but they were heavy.
Oh, they were heavy as a devil, I think. One man was all I could do to carry them. They were so awkward to carry, too. Of course, you didn't want to get the acid on you.
That sounds more like about a 40-ampere-hour battery. I'm trying to go back to 6 volts again. I have to remember. I can hardly remember 6-volt batteries. Okay. Okay, we had two of them. And you think you removed... You think they were both removed from both the guns?
Well, I think everything, they were using everything that day. I don't know whether they took the ones from the guns or not, because I left early. The gunner's mates might have been asked to get the guns, the batteries from the gun.
Well, he took, Cipriani took at least one of the batteries ashore with him the night before. Remember anything about that?
That might have been the reason. He might have needed a stronger battery.
Well,
I don't know what the cause of it was.
What Cipriani said, or I shouldn't say that. I haven't talked to Cipriani. I haven't been able to find him. I don't know what. He left the Coast Guard after that, and I've never been able to run down. Anyway,
well, I don't remember his name. I wouldn't be able to help you.
He was from the Taney, and he left the Taney after he wasn't with you on the ship. While you were going to the islands, he stayed on Hallam. He stayed there with the Hawaiian boys. I want to ask you a couple about people in the wardroom. Do you remember, by any chance, that there was a man on board with his 10-year-old son that took that cruise with you? His name was Welsh.
I think he was a captain's guest. I think it was the captain's guest, and the captain had a kid back there, I remember. So I think that's where he was living.
Okay. There was another guy on board from Honolulu. His name was... I can't remember his name.
Oh, there's so damn many of them.
Yeah, well, there's
as many as 100.
Okay, I won't bother with that. Okay, getting back to the batteries, Cipriani said that, or I should say, Commander Thompson said that in his report that Cipriani was unable to get a bearing on the on Amelia because his batteries went dead during the night.
You know, I have an idea that they didn't know what the hell happened there. I think the Japs closed in on her and told her they'd shoot her down if she touched that radio again, because everything went quiet just like that, see. She was supposed to be supposed to have landed. They were supposed to have taken her into a truck. And then she was later supposed to be at Saipan. I don't know. I can't figure it out.
I can't see how.
That's a long ways from it. And I don't know how those things happen. But I believe that that wasn't just the ship's fault, because they were begging her all the time to come in on that frequency, and she wouldn't. She come out and I heard her myself when I was past the radio shack. I stood there and listened to her. And they begged her to come in on that, whatever that frequency was, no. And she said, I'll come in on so-and-so. And that was it. And they'd say, we can't take you. They'd start explaining to her, we can't take you on that, but please come in on that. And they said that she was fixed, Newman knew she could change that over and come in on that circuit, on that frequency. But she wouldn't, for some reason or other.
Yeah, well,
Freeman was, he was going to quit her, you know, out there.
Who was that?
Her navigator.
Noonan?
Newman was going to quit her. He was going to quit her in Honolulu. If I ever got to Honolulu, he was going to quit. Because this Navy flyer that we had, did you talk to him?
Army flyer?
There was two Navy flyers. And both of them knew Newman. And they said that, they could have been Army. I don't know. I'm not sure now what they were. But... they said that he was going to quit her if he ever got to Honolulu. That she was lost was when this come out. He said if he ever got back to Honolulu, he was quitting her, but he's sick and tired of her. He passed the word to them some kind of way. I don't know whether he called them from Loy, where she left. I think that's where he must have called them or something and said he was heading back on a certain date or something. And he probably told me he was quitting in Hawaii when they got there.
Were you in on any of the report making that was done? You know, there were a lot of reports turned in about...
Only my own, but things that I was interested in myself, like that getting rid of those birds and things like that. We tried to make that up, but I don't know how much of that went in. I just gave me information on it, and that was all there was to it. There wasn't anything important about it, in my opinion.
Would you believe that I saw the bill for the shotgun shells that were bought?
How much was it?
It was 2,000 and something shotgun shells, and Putnam, he didn't believe that he said, "Yeah, I'm surprised you could."
I had around 12,000.
He got a bill for quite a large bill.
A lot of them were brought on the ship. I don't know how many was brought on the ship, but I always carried about 2,000 or 3,000, and I'd use a mesquite on the ship.
And you had 10 shotguns all together, and you were using them all. Huh? Okay, you weren't in on any.
Wait a minute, no, that wasn't 10. It was 5 on there.
5?
Cambridge had 10, not.
Oh, I see.
I'm getting Cambridge mixed up with that. They had 5. That was all we had on the
ice. I have pictures of the guys with the guns going ashore.
You do have pictures?
Yeah. Do you have any pictures at all?
Oh, I have. I have a. Down in my locker over there in the bottom of it somewhere, I had pictures of all over Europe and everything else all mixed up. And I.
Do you have anything back from the old Itasca days?
I don't know what's in there. I know there's a lot of them in there. There's like Neptune parties and things like that. I remember seeing them. But my son used to pick them out, and he used to take them to school and show them to people in school, all these people hanging. When I come back from Turkey, we were in the Dardanelles during the war. And I come back from Turkey, and when we went into Constantinople, they hung a bunch of, I think it was around 89 or so, they hung there at one time. They had a trap on the Istanbul Bridge, and they were trapping people and robbing them, cutting their heads off. They'd find their bodies with no heads. They found the heads in the bridge there where they had the traps.
Well, anyway, the reports that Commander Thompson turned in, Gus Schrode, you remember him? Yeah, he was a communications. He was a commander in communications in those
days. I didn't have too much to do with
it. He was back at headquarters. Anyway, Gus Schrode was working on a communication study, a case study, you know, the Amelia Earhart case, the Morro Bay case, or, you know, the Morro Castle case, or every distress case. Mm-hmm. There was a communication study done of all the important ones. Well, one was done on this, and Gus Schrode started anyway. And one of the main things that was used was Commander Thompson's abstract excerpts from the radio logs of the Itasca that were before the accident, during the accident, and then the search afterwards. He turned it into Honolulu. And he saw Secretary Morgenthau when they got back to Honolulu. Morgenthau happened to arrive on the Laureline that day. And Donald McKay was his aide who happened to be there. Did you know that?
No.
Okay. Anyway, Commander Thompson had to go over and pay his respect to Secretary Morgenthau. Of course, Secretary Morgenthau wanted to know what the hell went on down there. Anyway, he turned in this report, and the report left some very definite questions unanswered about, well, why this, you know? All the questions weren't answered. Now, I don't know if you know it or not, but Commander Thompson got the way she wanted to see him. Did you know about that?
No, I didn't know all about that.
Well, Commander Thompson got called up by Weishi, and we will probably never know for another 30 years, and probably everybody will forget it because you can't look at a man's record for 75 years, but I would give my left eye tooth to know what went on.
That's my old friend, Weishi. He and I used to run the Beal.
The what?
The Beal, he and I.
What is the Beal?
The Beal was the destroyer. Oh, I was the only watch officer. Can you figure that out?
Boy, no, I can't figure that out.
The executive officer was lieutenant commander, same as way she was. And he said, I'm not going to take any watches. In And I says, well, Mr. Lucas, I'm getting pretty tired of this. I'd have to watch. We'd come in from 16 days at sea, rum running. And I'd get the watch. In the next 24 hours, I'd turn my hat around and stand another 24 hours. They keep us up for 11 days, and I hadn't been ashore for 16 days before that. The ship hadn't even been in port. And finally, Wacy had come back to the ship. I told him, I said, Tranter, Wacy, I need to go ashore and get a haircut. I said, it's going down my neck now. I said, I don't like it. I said, I want to get something to eat. Change from this. We was in New London. And Wacy said, listen, you go ahead ashore now if you want. And he said, I'll relieve you. He wouldn't tell Lucas to relieve him, because Lucas had as much rank as he did. But, of course, he was senior to Lucas. But that was a hell of a way. And then we'd go to sea, and we'd get a suitcase boatswain. And he'd come on the ship, and the two of us would stand four on and four off. While we're sea for 16 days, you'd be dog tired. You'd come and put them in, turn your head around, and stand the suitcase boatswain would take another ship and go to sea. Oh, what a deal we were getting in those. I was in 24, 25 when I got those.
Oh, did you remember any of the Hawaiian boys at all? Did you ever have any?
Not by name. I know a lot of them when I see them. Like I told you, I saw them in Boston. There's a band come over there. And there were four or five of the boys in there that I had known out in Honolulu. And they'd played at Under the Stars there. What's his name? They played there, and they'd been Beach Boys and everything else, and I'd see them nearly every day. I got in there, and I went over to this lunchroom where we had lunch every day. And I'd say, this manager, what? Heck, don't they play Hawaiian music instead of that? He said, do you know anything about it? He said, if you do, go over and tell the waiter or the band leader to play Hawaiian music. So I went over, and he knew me. And I said, look, why don't you play Hawaiian music? He says, what'll I play? And I said, well, to start off with, why don't you play the cockeyed mayor of Kanakakai? And he said, do you think I would go over? I said, do you have a boy that can sing it? He said, yes. I said, go ahead and do it. And do you want to see it? They tore the house down. About 1,000 people could eat in that big exchange restaurant there. And then this manager got on the speaker over at the bandstand. He said, this young man from just got back from Hawaii. He just requested that song. And he wants him to play this song and that song. Well, then every day I'd come in there. They wouldn't take my pay. They wouldn't let me take anything. They wouldn't let me pay for the food I got. And his daughter would come over, and she'd want to know how to run a luau. And I'd tell her what she had to have for it. And she'd run one down, and she wanted me to come. And I said, look, I don't do that stuff for a living. I said, I have a lot of work to do in this business I'm in.
The boys, when they were on the ship, they were, you know, they were a fifth wheel. They didn't belong there. They probably seasick, half of them. And they didn't like the ship, really. They used to stay on deck a lot. They just didn't like it below. And
they didn't get enough fish and rice.
Yeah. Actually, you know, we must remember that during the mid-30s, they were less than full white
citizens.
Well,
we only paid them $1 a day out there. We paid them $1 a day to stay on the island. And before they got on, you talk about a rigid examination, they really got one for the teeth and everything. Before they let them stay, they keep four boys on the island. And then we'd pick them up 5 or 6 weeks later and put four more there. And if they were in good health and wanted to stay there, our doctor would check them and see if they were all right. He'd let them stay for another 5 or 6 weeks, whatever it was that we'd let them stay for, till we come down the next time.
But you really didn't have anything to do with them personally much?
No, only to talk to them and things like that.
But They were a separate group
altogether.
When I talked to them, they kept to themselves, and they didn't feel like they were a part of the ship, and they didn't feel like they were, you know, part of it. They didn't feel like they should associate with the Coast
Guard. Well, they'd have their banjos and run a party every night. They'd have playing. They'd have the whole crew around them every night. Up there playing and Hawaiian music and playing, dancing, doing the hula and things like that on the ship. But we used to have a good time with those kids. They were all young kids. They'd come back with beards. We had one that stayed down there for almost a year, you know. I don't know whether you run into him or not, but he had beard down to here when he came back.